for theflypod.com, I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover.
Today we have the New York Times bestselling author R.A. Salvatore, author of his brand new book, Road of the Patriarch. This a sellsword book, number three in the series.
Yep, number three and the last one in this series.
Yeah, welcome.
Well, it's good to be back. It's good to be back. Although now I guess I'm going to have to change my name back to Salvatore.
Yeah. Yeah, I think last time I was using that, wasn't
it? Well, no, I just got back from Italy, and they told me, no. No Salvatore. No.
That's not right.
They beat me up pretty good over there.
So every time you did an interview, it was always Salvatore.
No, it was always Salvatore. My father says we're American. It's Salvatore. I got to Italy, and they're like, no.
Okay, well, let's pick up here on the sellswords book three, the third one in the trilogy, Road to the Patriarch. Give us a little background on this book. What's it about?
Well, the main character in this book is a guy named Adamus Intrieri, who actually showed up in the first Dark Elf book that I wrote. He showed up in the last chapter of my first book back in 1988. And he's been kind of a villain in the books, the nemesis, the antagonist, through all these years until about, oh boy, I guess it was around 2000 when I wrote a book called Servant of the Shard. And he became the protagonist in that book, along with a dark elf companion that he picked up along the way. And it really occurred to me then that after all these years of teasing, it was time to tell his story. And I never expected it to go this way, but I wound up writing two more books about him.
Wow, really?
And this is it. This is his swan song.
There you go. So do you ever see him coming back?
I don't know. I never say never, but it's a shared world, and there are a lot of things going on in the world, and I have a lot of other books to write, so we'll see.
Okay.
We'll see.
Road to the Patriarch, there is a big party, a big celebration coming up in the kingdom.
Well, at the beginning, as unlikely as it sounds to anyone who knows the character, Adamus and his cohort are considered heroes, and they're going to be knighted even, which is, if you know the character, comical, because he's about as far from chivalrous and far from being a knight of an order as anyone could be. And of course, that just leads to bigger trouble for him.
There you go. And of course, you had to do that, or it wouldn't have been
No, you got to make it look like things are working out before you break it all apart again, at least.
There you go. All right, now, this, of course, Road to the Patriarch, like all the books that you're writing, fantasy.
Yeah.
How did you get involved with writing fantasy? How did you come to like that?
Well, I fell in love with fantasy in college. I read The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, and I started loving reading again. And because of that, I gravitated toward all the fantasy books I could find. But there weren't that many. This was back in the late 70s, early 80s. There were only a few authors working in the genre, because really it was just this tiny little subclass of science fiction at that time. But there was Terry Brooks and Michael Moorcock and Stephen Donaldson and Anne McCaffrey and Fritz Leiber and Tolkien, of course, and C.S. Lewis, of course, and that was it. So once I got done reading all of those books, I ran out of books to read that I wanted to read, so I wrote one.
Of course, in college at the time?
This was right after I got out of college when I wrote it. But yeah, this was during my college years, finishing up college.
Now, I even heard that you had switched your major in college.
Yeah, I was a math communications major. And what happened was, for Christmas of my freshman year, I got The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings as a gift. And I didn't know what they were. My sister couldn't explain it. There was no fantasy genre, if you will. A couple of months later, in February of 78, we had this tremendous blizzard shutdown everything in New England for a week, and I was, 19 years old and trapped at my mother's house, oh joy, for a week. So I read the books, and I went away to this wonderful world with a hobbit named Bilbo, and it was just incredible. And when I got back to school, I changed my major to communications, because in communications, all of my electives became literature courses. I had forgotten how much I loved to read when I was a kid. Going through school kind of beat the reading out of me, but I fell back in love with reading. And that was because of those books.
So when you were writing or reading these books, now you're starting to want to write fantasy. Did you use their worlds? Did you use your own, a combination?
Well, I created my own when I started. And then when my first published book was set in the Forgotten Realms, which is a world that was created by a guy named Ed Greenwood, who sold it to TSR, now Wizards of the Coast, but that was the company that did the Dungeons & Dragons game. And when I sent my original manuscript into them, they liked it, but said they didn't have any room on their schedule for original manuscripts. And would I be willing to do a Forgotten Realms book? So I asked, what are the Forgotten Realms? They weren't even out yet. And it's this gigantic shared world that TSR was building for their game products and for authors to come in and write novels. And we couldn't set my book there because it was an entirely different type of fantasy. So they asked me if I would audition to do a book set in their world. And I did, and that became The Crystal Shard back in 1988, early 1988 it came out.
So when they're giving you these instructions on their world, I mean, they give you like a blueprint?
Well, I get a map of the world, and basically my job for many years was just to stay out of everybody else's way. And there are some restrictions because it's based on the role-playing game, Dungeons & Dragons. And so you kind of have to stay within the parameters of the magic system and all the other things that they set up in that game. But as far as the writing itself goes and the creative freedom, I mean, I can't blow up the major cities in the world, but I stay far enough away from everyone else so I can write the books just the way I want to, usually.
Well, you know, talking about magic in Roads of the Patriarch in the Still Swords book series, explain some of the magic that you have going on in this book, some of the...
Well, there's a lot of magicians. Different types of magic. In this book, Artemis and Treri's sidekick is a dark elf named Jarl Axel, and Jarl Axel is known for his magic items. In fact, I ran into a little bit of a problem when I wrote the first book in this, in that I realized I was going to use Jarl Axel as a protagonist. And after a dozen cameos and a dozen different books, each time showing off new toys, I realized I have no idea what this guy has for equipment, for items, for magic toys, if you will. So what I did, I'm sitting there, I've got 4 months to write this book, and I'm looking at a stack of books, you know, as high as my waist, and I'm thinking, I got to dig through all of those. So what I did is I went on a message board thread anonymously, and I typed in, hey guys, let's do an inventory of Jarl Axel's magical items. And 2 days later, I came back and downloaded this 10-page thread where they had details, what he had, what they knew it did, what they thought it might do, what pages on what books. It was great. It was great. So I just grabbed the books, and I looked it up, and sure enough, they were right on everyone, and it made my work easier. But he's got all kinds of, like, on the cover, you see them riding nightmares, which are summoned horses from the abyss, and they're summoned through magical figurines, and Jarl Axel's got all kinds of toys.
One of my favorite characters in the book is a lady, and she owns a silver shop.
Oh, the Dragon Sisters. Yeah, I've got a pair of dragons. I actually wrote a short story for a book called Realms of the Dragons, and I wanted to do a different take on dragons, so I've got these two sisters who are rivals. One's got a gold shop, and one's got a silver shop, and they're dragons, but they don't ever show their true form. They walk around as people, and they're getting along, and the people are cool with it, and the rulers know who they are, and as long as they behave themselves, everyone's cool with it. But yeah, we've got a couple of dragons walking around.
Now, I thought that they really couldn't come to their full form in front of people because that might get them kicked out of the village or
kicked out or killed. I mean, it would or it would send the entire village fleeing. So they're part of the deal with the king, whose last name is Dragonslayer. I mean, Dragonsbane, Gareth Dragonsbane, and he earned it. Part of the deal is that they'll behave themselves and they'll stay out of those dragon forms, and that's why I love fantasy. You can just let your mind go crazy.
Well, some of the other players in this book, you've got gargoyles?
Yeah, monsters, yeah.
Monsters? Yeah. What other kind of monsters and people? And
this book is more human-centered or character-centered. So when I say human meaning human, dark elf, dwarf, and all the rest. But there aren't as many monsters and monstrous encounters in this book, other than with the dragons, who aren't really enemies in the book. it's much more, this book has got much more of a political flavor to it and a philosophical flavor to it, because Wrath of the Patriarch refers to Artemus Cintreri's journey home to find out where he came from and to find out why he is the way he is. That's a question that's been nagging me for many years. He's a cold-blooded, perfect warrior who kind of hides from life through physical discipline by making himself the best he can be with the sword. Is his way of hiding his emotions from the world. And through another bit of magic, Jarl Axel, his companion, is manipulating him through this magical flute, manipulating his emotions and forcing him to start feeling, kind of opening up, you know, pulling the ice off that heart, scraping the ice off the heart, forcing him to feel. And part of that process, the healing process for him would be to go home and to find out, you know, from whence he came. And to face up to the truths that he had long buried in his past. So it's a very personal journey for him all the way through.
You know, you were talking about the political bent on this book, and the king, he is more or less knighting a few people that have done some different things in battle. And in your book, you mentioned something like that the king is doing this so the people that are starving and that they're going through bad times, you know, they have somebody to look up to, isn't it?
That's part of it.
Isn't that what it's all about anyway?
Well, I think the most important, well, it was funny because they did this book, it came out in audio as well, and it's abridged and unabridged. There were two different audio versions. And for the abridged version, I got to look over the script to see what they were cutting. And it freaked me out because I think the most important scene in the entire book is at one point Artemis, when the deception is realized and they find out he's not a good guy, he's imprisoned. And he has a couple of one-on-ones with the king. And the whole point of it is what it is to be a king. And, you know, Artemis looking at this supposedly goodly king, looking him in the eye and saying, "You're afraid of me because you're afraid that I'm you." And I thought that was the most important scene in the book, other than Artemis' journey home, which, of course, is what this is all about. But, yeah, I mean, when you're writing a book, I think that in my books there are a million analogies to be found or none to be found. It's completely up to the reader. And I'm not going to answer any questions, but hopefully I'm asking them. Because if, you know, as a writer, even though I'm writing fantasy, I have to be drawing on the themes that I see around me, on the struggles, you know, on the struggles, political, religious, philosophical, theological. That's where drama comes from. And I draw on all of those things and transform them, put them through the blender, if you will, and they come out in different forms in the fantasy books. But the questions are universal. The question of power, might for right or might is right. The question of what it is to be a king. The question of, you know, just war. All of those questions are they're eternal in reasoning beings' experience. And if I'm not going to reflect them, if I'm not going to have relevance in my book, then why the heck am I writing books? You know, that to me, I mean, I can write a battle scene, whoop-de-doo. If the battle doesn't have a purpose, if there's no meaning behind it, if there are no deeper questions being asked, it's just a battle.
All right, let's take a look at the rest of the books, the other two books in this series, the Sellswords series.
Yeah.
Pretty much take us through maybe each book a little bit, not to give much away.
Well, the first book, Servant of the Shard, really wasn't part of this series when I wrote it. It was actually part of another series that involved Dritz, the main character in most of my other books, and his gang as well. Servant of the Shard was really about Jarl Axel, who's now the manipulator, being manipulated by a magic item and going kind of power crazy with this magic item, which is causing all kinds of problems and scaring the heck out of Intrary, because Jarl Axel is the only buffer he's got against these dark elves, who are, as bad as he is, they're worse. And so he can't have Jarl Axel fall. So the whole book is about his struggle to save Jarl Axel from himself, if you will. But he's not doing it for Jarl Axel's benefit as much as he is for his own. The second book in the series, Promise of the Witch King, I noticed something when I started writing the book, and you know, I've been writing for the company that does Dungeons and Dragons for years now. And so one of the if you will, cliche comments is, it's a dungeon crawl. But nobody's ever written a dungeon crawl. What does that mean? Well, I wanted to try writing a dungeon crawl. So I took these two guys and a few other side characters, and I put them in this very tight spot where they were under pressure for the entire book. It's almost like, oh, let me think of a movie that would fit. Remember the movie 10 Little Indians? Was it 10 Little Indians or however number it was, where they were stuck in a house and people were getting killed one by one? It's something similar to that, where they're in this one place for the bulk of the book and they can't get out easily. They have to finish what they're there to do. And it's really bad, and they're all kind of working against each other and with each other at the same time. So it's all this backstabbing and group dynamics, if you will, going on. But it was a dungeon crawl. And when I sent it in, my editor called me up, and he said, hey, you wrote a dungeon crawl. And I said, yeah. And he said, yeah, I've never seen one before. This is really cool. And I had a blast, and I learned a lot. I learned a lot about the characters. And it was in that book and writing that book and getting to know Artemis and Jarl Axel so well that I realized now I need the book that expands everything. That, you know, the Promise of the Witch King tightened everything down into this, really tightened it down a lot. Now I need to blow the bolt off and widen the horizons and send Artemis finding his past and his home and who he is. So that was the progression of the series, basically.
That almost sounded like a Alfred Hitchcock movie at one time. There was one movie that was taken just in an apartment, and you could look out and everything. And
yeah.
I forget what it was called, but...
Rear Window was one.
Yeah, Rear Window. Yeah. Pretty much on that same line, I guess.
Yeah. It was something akin to that, where you take a group of people and you put them in an incredibly pressure-filled situation in a small, contained environment where they're not going to get a lot of outside interaction or help. And just to see what happens. And I figured it's hard to do and hard to keep someone's attention, but with Artemis and Jarl Axel, the banter between these two has grown so easy for me to do. I know who they are. Their voices just ring very true in my head now. So I tried it, and it seemed to work. And now with this one, I completed Artemis's tale the way I wanted to.
With, you know, talking about Alfred Hitchcock, when he would do movies every once in a while, he would take one shot and go from to different scenes all the time without moving or without breaking the camera. Do you ever do that with your books? Do you write maybe the way that you might see it? Do you write like maybe somebody might direct a movie?
All of them. Absolutely. Because it's the way I grew up. I grew up watching movies and watching television. So there are a lot of point of view changes in my books. The battle scenes are very visual. I do it always with a movie in mind. Not having in mind I'm going to turn this into a movie, but it's because that is the type of communication that I'm most familiar with, most comfortable with, and enjoy the most, is that type of cinematic progression. And I'm convinced that I was in England many years ago with an author named Tom DeHaven, who wrote a book called Walker of Worlds, wonderful book. And we were interviewing with BBC, and they asked us why Tolkien wasn't popular with the kids. This was before the Peter Jackson movies, which renewed the world's love for Tolkien. But before that, the books really weren't that popular any longer. And so why are your books popular and Tolkien's not? And Tom DeHaven came up with, you know, he presented his thesis. He's a professor at University of Virginia. And Tom, I thought he was right on. He said that Tolkien wrote for an audience that didn't grow up on television. We write for an audience that did. So the books are faster paced, more point of view shifts, more action to tie the scenes together. And now thinking about that, I'm convinced that, you know, the people who will replace me and Terry Brooks and the rest of the crew that are out there now will be the kids who grew up with message boards and video games, because that's an entirely different form of communication. And it's really the sensibilities of the audience. My sensibilities go to the movies and television. And so, yes, my books are cinematic, if you will. It's the way I think.
So when somebody comes up now that has been brought up on message boards and other things like that, how are their books going to be different, do you think?
It'll be subtle, but it'll be real. And I've already started adapting my style a little bit. In writing 101, one of the first things you learned is that good dialogue doesn't need to be attributed. If you're doing good dialogue, the reader should know who's speaking. And the other thing is, the road to hell is paved with adverbs, right? So if you have to say he said it sarcastically, you failed, because the words should say sarcastically. That doesn't work anymore. Because if you look on message boards and you look at the sensibilities of the younger audience, every line on a message board or in the chat room is attributed. They don't have to develop the skills of figuring out whose voice it is. And not only that, but very few, you know, kids today do not have the face-to-face interaction that we had when I was a kid. They're home on Instant Messenger with 12 of their friends. That's how they get together at night. And so if you don't attribute dialogue, you can lose younger readers very quickly. And the other thing is, if you ever go on the message board, the first thing you realize is that whenever you're kidding, you have to do something. Whenever you're saying something sarcastically or as a joke, what do you have to do? You have to put a smiley face at the end of the line. Well, smiley face or all those other emoticons are adverbs. And on a message board, if you don't put a smiley face and you say a joke, it's not a joke, and you've started a flame war. So I find myself using more adverbs now and attributing dialogue more. And that's just two examples, very small examples of how it goes, of how the flow is changing back to adapt to the audience. Now, this is not a put-down on the audience. In those ways, in face-to-face communication, in catching the sarcasm, they may not be as sophisticated. But in other ways, they're far more sophisticated. The ability of a younger person today to absorb information is astounding. If you've ever watched a kid going through 15 or 16 instant message conversations at the same time, flipping it up, knowing exactly who it is, and picking up the conversations if they never left. Bang, 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 minimizing that one, popping up another one. Bang, 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 minimizing, popping up. It's incredible to watch. So the way people actually absorb information is changing.
You know, it almost sounds like going back to old-time radio when people would listen to the radio, whether it be the Long Ranger or whoever. They've got this in their mind. It's their own thought of how this person looks. It's almost the same as on the message board, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. And I think in the video games, it's even more amazing the changes that are taking place in games like World of Warcraft and The Sims Online or Second Life or EverQuest, where people are online, they've got graphic representations that they've chosen as their kind of, they call them toons, you know, their character. And they walk around and they converse and they interact with other people in this virtual world. They buy virtual land with virtual money. Sometimes they buy it with real money via eBay. It is an incredible shift that's coming in the way we communicate and the way we entertain. And it's very fundamental. And it's very real. And I'm convinced that the author, the next step for the author will be, how does the author fit into the computer game? And actually, I've just become the creative director for a computer game company for just that reason, to explore exactly that. What is the role of the storyteller in a world where, if you do it right, all of the players are going to tell their own stories? You see? So you're not spoon-feeding them a story. They're telling their own stories in the context of the world you give them. It's amazing, and it's worth exploring.
Now, I was going to bring up also about the games. Not only that, but I had a question if you had games off of your characters in the books.
There have been some. Demon Stone for the PlayStation, and I think it went to the Xbox too, had some of my characters in it. Baldur's Gate, Icewind Dale. A lot of those games had some of my characters in them. Not like what's going on now with the new game companies, but yeah. Yeah, and I really think that the video game industry is actually bigger than the movie industry now. And it's the discrepancy is going to get huge. Right now it's, you know, a little bit more, but it's just going to continue to separate itself. People are going to be playing video games more than they're watching television in the very near future. I guarantee it.
You were just mentioning that your book, Road to the Patriarch, is on audio cassette, yep. Probably on CD also, yep. Abridged.
Well, it's on CD. CD. Yeah, not on cassette anymore.
Wow.
Yeah. And we've broken through to the real world now.
There you go. And I've even seen them in different things, almost like little eye tune type things
you MP3s,
can buy.
Yeah,
which is just amazing. But who does your books? Are you reading those? Somebody else?
No, they hire an actor to come in and do it. I'd love to on some of them, but they hire an actor.
You listen to him?
You know, I haven't listened to any other than Vector Prime, which was the Star Wars book I did that was abridged, and it was pretty amazing. I'm going to listen to Road of the Patriarch eventually. It's hard because they may mispronounce things or, you know, it's hard. But now that it's on abridged, I never liked listening to the abridged ones because I was always just seething about things they had. Don't cut out, don't cut my work. You know, this ego thing kicks in. But now that I have an unabridged one, I'll probably spend some time. It just showed up at my house, actually, in the mail. So I'll probably spend some time and actually hear what I wrote.
I was talking to an author, and I forget who it was, as we left the studio, and he mentioned that his book was on audio tape. And he didn't really like it that much because he's writing it, and his characters have their own voice. Do you find that also?
Well, in Vector Prime, I didn't. But then most of the characters had a voice long before I got to them, because we're talking Luke Skywalker and Princess Leia, and they had their own voice before I ever got to them. I'm a little worried about that. What's Intrary going to really sound like in someone else's hands? But at the same time, I don't shy from it anymore, because one of the things that I'm really starting to enjoy now that I'm kind of the old man on the block instead of the young punk kid coming up, you know, 20 years in the business here. One of the things I'm really enjoying is watching people take what I've created and adapt it and inject their own creativity. And I'll give you a perfect example. They're doing my Dark Elf books in graphic novels. Devil's Due from out of Chicago are converting them to graphic novels. And they're just fantastic. And the writer is doing an amazing job. And the illustrator is doing an amazing job. So much so that I sold my Demon Wars series to them. To do graphic novels with those as well. So at this point, I'm really sitting back and enjoying watching adaptations of my work, like Museum Replicas did Dritz Scimitars. And it's fun. It's fun for me.
This has been Cover to Cover. I've been your host, Mark DeWitt. We've been talking with R.A. Salvatore, author of his brand new book, Road of the Patriarch. Of course, look for the other books in this series. You'll want to start with Servant of the Shard, and then Promise of the Witch King, and Road of the Patriarch. Thanks a lot, Ari.
Been great being here again.
To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.